This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont has another notch in its belt when it comes to local food. We ranked first in the second annual Strolling of the Heifers Locavore Index. The survey ranks all 50 states and the District of Columbia on their commitment to local food. Maine and New Hampshire followed Vermont on the list. Among the criteria is access to local foods through things like CSAs and farmers markets. Whitney Lamy of Castleton Crackers started selling her product at the Rutland Farmers Market, and it's been growing ever since.
You know, a farmer's market is the ideal marketing situation. You get to go every week. You get firsthand feedback from customers tasting your product. Is the price point right? How does the flavor sit with customers? Are people coming back because they like your product? To me, there's no better marketing resource.
But before we give ourselves too many pats on the back, local food is still not accessible to everyone, and there is room for improvement, even in Vermont. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to explore what Vermont is doing well when it comes to local food consumption, delivery, and production, and what still needs a little work. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the value of local foods. Is it worth it to focus on eating local, buying local, producing local? And what do you see as challenges that we still face? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're joined today from our new Brattleboro studio by Martin Langeveld, coordinator of the Locavore Index and the marketing director for the Strolling of the Heifers. Martin, it is so nice to have you in our spanking new studio.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
We're also going to talk today with Philip Ackerman Leist, author of Rebuilding the Food Shed, How to Create Local, Sustainable, and Secure Food Systems. Philip, even though you're not in that studio, it's lovely to have you as well.
Thank you, Jane. Glad to be here. And feel free to build a studio at Greenhouse College anytime you like.
Absolutely. That'll be our next step. Martin, let's get this out of the way first, because I know you've had to deal with it already. A Vermont organization ranks Vermont first in the nation on a locavore index. Sounds a little fishy. Defend yourself.
Right. Well, we didn't set out to do that. We didn't set out to make Vermont number one, but that's what happened. Strolling the Heifers, as you know, has been focused on connecting people with local farmers, local food, since 2002. And last year, we decided that, you know, since local food is such a vibrant and movement across the country, it involves so many people, it gets so much attention, that really it was time to look at the metrics. Can we figure out, you know, how much local food is there? And can we figure out which states are doing it well and which are not? So when we started to look around, we found a few metrics, not very many. We can get into that. But when we put the table together, lo and behold, Vermont was number one. But there were surprises. You know, there are states like Iowa, North Dakota, Montana that also rank very high.
What about for you, Philip? Would Vermont rank first on your list if you were compiling your own list of locavore states?
Sure. It's right up there, and other folks around the country recognize that. I mean, we really are a model in many ways, I think, both by virtue of the numbers and then also the reputation. And we've been at it long enough. It shouldn't be a real surprise to us. But there are others who you know, should be able to share the crown as well.
Like who?
Yeah, you know, as Martin mentioned, I think there's some really interesting projects going on in places like Montana, Rhode Island, New Mexico is really doing a great job, Virginia's pushing ahead. So, you know, it's really exciting to look around the country. And, you know, in some ways it depends upon the metrics that you might utilize. But, you know, these places are really putting together a lot of collaborative efforts and trying to build things out. So it's exciting to see it happen.
Before we get into those metrics, let's go to Eileen, who's calling in from Chittenden. Hi, Eileen. Go right ahead.
Hi. Oh, I'd like to say that I'm just happy that the people have turned around and no longer are looking at the processed food as being the absolute ultimate. My mother is a person who put the canned food on, opened it up, and heated it. God knows what we were getting. And most of it was salt. And now people are opening up things, cutting their own tomatoes, eating their own fresh fruit. And I have to say that I've noticed a change in the way that people's metabolism, even in my family, has increased. We've lost weight. There's, like, I think that eating healthy and the promotion of good fruit and vegetables are only going to do anything but benefit who we are as a nation.
Well, Eileen, thanks for calling in. Eileen, really appreciating the local food system. She says she's seeing benefits for it in her family. Listeners, if you want to share your thoughts about local foods, sustainable, community-sourced food, and where you see the challenges to this model, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts at vpr.net on the Vermont Edition page. All right, Martin Langeveld, give us the metrics that you're using here, farmers markets, CSAs, and food hubs. Why those three elements?
Well, those three elements because really we looked long and hard at a lot of other possibilities, but those were the three for which we could get reliable, consistent, and very up-to-date numbers from all 50 states. There are other things we could look at. We could look at the number of farm-to-school programs, for example, but we just couldn't find reliable data on those. Now, next year, we hope to expand to a lot of other metrics that are being gathered right now by the USDA. They did an agricultural census late in 2012. Those numbers should be available by early 2013. So in the next index in 2014, we think that we can broaden this quite a bit and make it more representative of the whole local foods systems in these states.
But farmers markets and CSAs, there are reliable lists in every state. I mean, I wouldn't imagine that every state necessarily keeps a list.
Yeah, but the USDA does. Mm. The USDA has a database of farmers markets. They have them actually by precise location if you wanted to do mapping. And they update it every month. And as a matter of fact, that list is a good indicator of the degree to which this movement is growing because this year there were about 9% more farmers markets on that list than there were just a year ago. For CSAs, we used another source, which is an organization called Local Harvest, because the USDA's list of CSAs hasn't been updated since 2007. That's one of the things that we hope they will do. And then USDA also has a good list of food hubs by state.
And Vermont just ranks first per capita in all of those departments?
Right. It's important to note that this is per capita. So we took those numbers, we created a weighted average, and then we divided by population to get a per capita. I didn't look actually whether the per capita rank for Vermont is first in each of those, but in the combined score, the raw number that Vermont comes out with is 16.9 of those per capita. The next state, Vermont, is 6.96. So you can see that there is quite a large lead.
The next state, Maine, you mean?
Maine, yeah, and then all of the other 50 states, the distance between the states is fairly small, relatively small. But Vermont has a very large lead, at least in this way of measuring local foods.
Philip Ackerman-Leist, your recent book is all about creating local food systems and sustainable food systems. What do you see in Vermont's infrastructure that's really working well?
Sure. I think, you know, the infrastructure is really important. What I think we really have the advantage in is really the relationships that we've utilized and the number of players that have come to the table here to work these things out. And it's, that's really ranged. Certainly the Agency of Agriculture has been more proactive than many agencies across the country. NOFA Vermont has been fantastic in moving things forward. And, you know, their work with Vermont Feed has been fantastic. UVM is, I think, one of the most progressive land grants in the country. They saw this well ahead of many other land grants, you know, across the country. And other higher ed groups have stepped up. And then we've got all the regional food groups that have come together, the Food Funders Network, Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund, regional hospitals. I mean, it's a really amazing collaboration at levels at which most states, frankly, haven't been able to function yet.
We'll talk a little bit more about that, Philip, the things that aren't necessarily in this index but that are working in Vermont, things like the farm-to-school programs and institutional programs, hospitals serving local food.
Right. You know, this farm-to-institution piece is enormous, and particularly as you look at the national statistics, you know, we're, whether you measure it by calories or by dollars, you know, we now have a new category called away-from-home food, and it's pushing 50% in both of those measures here for the average American. So, you know, many folks like myself, you know, eat at colleges, senior centers, hospitals, you know, throughout the week, and the public schools, of course. So, you know, we really need to be focusing on that, because it's not always just the direct farm-to-consumer sales that are important, but also, you know, these farm-to-consumer, these farm-to-institution programs can really, you know, help provide more markets for farmers, more opportunities to get things out there, and more opportunities for people to eat locally, even if they're not at home.
We are talking today about the Locavore Index. Vermont just ranked first on it. It's done by Strolling of the Heifers, which is a Vermont organization. But our guest, Martin Langeveld, promises it was all done on metrics, not on, you know, extra favors that Vermont is doing for itself. We're also talking with Philip Ackerman Leist, who's the author of Rebuilding the Food Shed, How to Create Local, Sustainable, and Secure Food Systems. And we're hearing from many of you, our listeners, who have a lot of experience with local food systems and some questions. You can post all of your thoughts at vpr.net. Just go to the Vermont Edition page or call 1-800-639-2211. Miriam's calling in from East Montpelier. Hi, Miriam. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a gardener who's recently become a commercial grower, and my understanding is that we're still getting about 90% of our food from outside the state. And so my question is twofold. A, is, you know, is this a true representation of how much of the food comes from outside? And B, you know, what do you see happening that's going to change that? If we're at the top of the locavore community, then that's not a very good showing.
Yeah, Miriam, thanks for the call. Interesting to point out, as we look at how much local food we're consuming, it's still a small proportion of all the food that we are consuming in the state. Philip, let's start with you. Do you know the actual percentage?
Well, I think, you know, as we have all been trying to measure it over the past, you know, almost 10 years now, it's a really complicated endeavor to do that. And, you know, 10% is probably a bit optimistic. You know, I think we're just different studies I've seen, I think it's probably closer to 5 or 6% at this point.
Is local food.
Right. And, you know, it's a complicated matter. And I agree with Miriam that, you know, in some ways it's a bit depressing. And yet, on the other hand, you know, what we really spent about two or three generations taking apart the local food systems in the United States. And so, you know, this is a long process, and I hope that, you know, the media hype, that we don't lose that as we go along, because it really is the rebuilding of, you know, at least a generation to push this thing out. And just in the last couple of years, we've really taken the low-hanging fruit, and now we, you know, we really have the responsibility of doing the more complicated pieces and trying to work with the infrastructure and build that out so that we can get the efficiencies into place that really do matter.
Martin, pick up on that. Where do you see this next step going? If we've taken the low-hanging fruit already, we've got the farmers markets, we've got the CSAs, we've got the easy places to get local food into. What's next?
Well, you know, first I would agree that it's probably well less than 10% that is grown within the state. I mean, you just have to look around any supermarket and look at the huge amount of food, and you know that most of that didn't come from within the state. And also, you know, we should talk about, what does local really mean? What's the definition of local? It's not necessarily within the state. I mean, I live next to the Connecticut River, and I would consider New Hampshire food to be local as well. And also, you know, it goes back, as Phil said, it's, you know, two, three generations, probably even more. I mean, 150 years ago, there was a milk train out of Brattleboro. That's where the word milk train comes from, is you know, bringing butter and eggs and cheese and milk from Vermont down to Boston. But in a way, that should be considered local food. I mean, any city today has to import its food from somewhere. And so what we need to encourage is for local food movements to make more incursions into the cities. For CSAs, and there is a CSA, I believe, in Vermont that delivers food down into subscribers down into the Boston area, you know, to sort of expand the connections. And that is not low-hanging fruit. That takes a lot more work to have a farmer's market in downtown metropolitan cities.
We got a note from Gabrielle, who posted on our Facebook page, saying, being a somewhat recent transplant to Vermont, I'm impressed at the connection between consumers and producers and farmers, etc., and the grocery co-ops, restaurants, schools, hospitals, and others who are not only sourcing local foods, but nurturing and promoting the importance of small-scale, locally-owned, sustainable farm and food production practices. Listeners, if you have thoughts about local food, what you're seeing, what you're not seeing, you know, what are you seeing at the grocery store? What are you doing in your own life? Do you find sustainability in sourcing your foods locally or not? Do you find that your wallet is affected differently when you try to eat local foods? Let us know. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're going to talk in a few moments about more of the challenges, more of the areas that we have still to work on to make sure that we are improving local food access and local food markets. And we'll take more of your comments. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking local food with the coordinator of the Strolling of the Heifers Locavore Index, Martin Langeveld, and with author Philip Ackerman Leist, who's also a professor of sustainable agriculture at Green Mountain College, and he's the owner himself of a small dairy and cattle farm. And many of you are sharing your thoughts about access to local food on our webpage at vpr.net and by calling 1-800-639-2211. That number again is 1-800-639-2211. And let's go to Lee, who's calling in from Maine. Hi, Lee. So Maine's second on the list. Congratulations to you, too.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could speak to the fact that both Vermont and Maine do seem to be doing pretty well in the local food movement, but I don't see us working collaboratively together all that much. And if you have thoughts on what we could do to be working together to learn from each other a little bit more.
Lee, thanks for the call. Martin Langeveld, what do you see? Collaboration between Vermont and Maine.
Well, there's a state in between us, and we could maybe pull them in too. But yeah, I would say, as I said before, I think that this really crosses state lines. And so if we can have initiatives, you know, for example, does Dartmouth-Hitchcock source local food from Vermont? I'm sure they do. Maybe they source some from Maine as well. So definitely the farm-to-school, farm-to-institution, farm-to-table should cross state lines, and maybe that is one of those sort of next not so low hanging fruits that we could work on is ways to collaborate.
Philip Ackerman Leist, do you see things that other states are doing, like things that maybe Maine is doing that Vermont could either collaborate with or learn from and adopt ourselves?
Sure. And, you know, I think first and foremost, the collaborative piece is really important there. And that's beginning to happen. You know, there are different groups, you know, throughout the Northeast now that are beginning to meet and discuss ways in which to collaborate. And I think that's really important because obviously, you know, what we do with our local food systems is certainly important. But we have to do this at the regional scale as well. And that really helps us develop, some of the efficiencies that we need, also create, through aggregation and other means, actually create the really the robustness of the markets, you know, the quantities that we need to satisfy some of these markets. So that collaboration is beginning to happen and is being coordinated. So I'm really excited about the possibilities there. And it's not that we have to lose local in the process. It really is connecting local communities at that point and providing some broader opportunities.
Are either of you seeing specific things in some of those states that maybe are surprising, at least to people in our area, that are high on the list, North Dakota, Iowa, Montana, that we perhaps just don't know about that we could be adopting? I mean, Martin, are there really unique things out there that we just don't know about?
Well, Philip ran through some of the things that are going on in Vermont, and I'm not sure that I've seen anything in other states that we could be picking up on. I do notice that, you know, when you look at what is going on in the states that are high, that rank high in the index, and some of the surprising ones like North Dakota and Iowa, Montana, you know, you'll find that the Department of Agriculture and the state government in general in those places is really encouraging local foods, has it high on the list. There are grassroots organizations. And if you look at the ones that are farther down the list, you just don't see as much of that going on. So one of the morals of the story is that the state really needs to stay involved in the way that Vermont has been.
So you actually need policies, statewide politics, getting involved in local food.
Right. And Vermont is still looking for new things in this area. I mean, for example, right now they're in the process of figuring out who gets these Working Landscape Initiative grants, about $900,000 that I think there was about $8 million worth of applications for. So they're trying to sort that out. But that's all going to grassroots food efforts.
We're talking about local food today, access to local food, what our area is doing well, and where we still have some room for improvement. Let's go to Mark, who's calling in from Fletcher. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a long-time resident of Vermont. I'm an out-of-stater, but I've been here 30 years, and I've watched. I'm a chef, an educator, and gardener, and I'm retired now. So I'm spending more time thinking and applying towards local foods, and what the big gaps I'm seeing in the whole scheme of things, which has really been manipulated by the middlemen, is that you've got 90% of your food coming from out-of-state sources, mostly the markets in Chelsea and Massachusetts, and then all those trucks going back fairly empty usually, which could be carrying Vermont product back to the central market if the middlemen could be convinced to cooperate or whatever. The other interest I have is that if local farmers were given a price in a locale depot, a large refrigerated warehouse, say, an old barn that was even renovated for that, and given a price for a fairly steady price for what they produce, Vermonters could grow a lot more than they are. I just think the producers are getting short shrifted in the whole deal, as usual, and that they need to work out this marketing scheme much better than they have, and I believe the state needs to be involved.
Mark, thanks very much for your comments. Appreciate those thoughts. Mark, a chef, thinking about these ideas. Let's go to John, get another comment in here from John in Bethel. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Yes, my question is actually, I think it's pretty obvious that we all want to support the local economies, and there's nothing fresher than local food, that's for sure. But I'm curious as to the prices, the cost of buying local. I mean, it seems that there would be less processing, less transportation costs, and so I feel that those should be kind of rolled into the price to the consumer because, again, we want to support local markets and farmers markets and local economies, but it's sometimes the prices are just outrageous, and how do we quantify that in terms of the savings that, you know, the obvious savings that we think we're getting, but it's very expensive to buy local foods.
Yeah, John, let's pick it up from there. Philip, what about this idea? I mean, first of all, it depends on what kind of food you're talking about, but certainly some local foods, at least, are more expensive.
Right. You know, and I do think it's important to point out that there is a pretty big discrepancy sometimes, you know, between markets and between producers. So, you know, that's an important thing to bear in mind. But it is an issue. I mean, we've used local at this point, you know, really as a value-added term. And that obviously is something that gives farmers the ability to boost the prices some. So, you know, part of it is the fact that we really have used this value-added component to local. But then there's also the issue of, you know, a scale and certain efficiencies. And, you know, we've done a really good job in Vermont with small, diversified agriculture, and certainly that's something I've been teaching here at Green Mountain College for years. And one of the realizations that I've had over the last 5 or 10 years really has been that we do have to build out the middle. You know, there's a middle scale that's really missing in many places in Vermont. And, you know, if we can do that in such a way that farmers still get a fair price, but consumers also can have a price that they feel like they can afford, you know, then it really is worth doing that. And so it's an issue in some cases just of, you know, the supply not being what it might be. And, you know, particular areas where that needs to grow, in my view, would be with poultry, number one, you know, certainly also with swine. And then, you know, the possibilities of grains are really interesting, too.
What about vegetables? Are you saying it's an economy of scale that tomato that I buy, if it's from a big enough producer, even if I'm buying it at a farmer's market, I can get it for the same price? But if it's a small producer with higher labor costs for just, you know, one or two people, then it's going to cost more?
Yeah, you know, and again, I do think it varies farmer to farmer and market to market. But, you know, very often being able to increase some of the efficiencies in terms of scale does actually allow us to bring the prices down somewhat. You know, and I'm somewhat nervous in saying that because I think a lot of times, you know, what we really want to have happen is that we support these smaller diversified farmers and help them build their way into these, you know, these bigger markets and increase in terms of some of their scale and efficiency. And not everyone's going to do that, but we do need to encourage those who are willing to do that to build that up and out.
We got a note from Carrie Abels, who's the editor of Vermont's Local Banquet magazine. She posted on Facebook saying, it does seem that if we're to increase the accessibility of local food, we need to reach people in supermarkets and its mid-sized farms that can provide the volume of food that supermarkets require. Martin, are you seeing that as well, that may be an area of growth for Vermont and the local food movement is slightly bigger farms?
Yeah, definitely. As long as we don't get away from the idea that, you know, this that farms being diversified, having multiple crops, that there's, you know, a value in that as opposed to sort of monocultural approaches, which is what got us to where we are.
How about this idea about pricing, though? How do we make sure that this local food movement, as it continues to grow, isn't an upper middle class movement, that it's something that can embrace everybody who lives in a state, Martin?
Yeah, it's difficult because, you know, if you think about it, it's really the efficiencies of scale that the mega farms, sort of factory farms and efficient transportation have brought. That's what has gotten us to where 90% of our food or more is not local. But the other thing to realize is that in that whole transportation system, there's an awful lot of waste. There's a number out there from a survey that suggests that about 40% of the food that's produced in the United States is wasted. It's left in the field. It's wasted in transportation. It's thrown out by the supermarket if it's not sold in 3 days. It's wasted in the back of your refrigerator if you forget about it. And so personally, I'm willing to spend a little bit more for local food because I know I'm not going to waste it. And so I'm much less likely to throw out a limp head of local lettuce than, you know, something else that might have come from farther away. Because I bought it at the farmer's market. I know the farmer who produced it, and I'm going to value it. And so there's a little premium in that.
Let's quickly get another call in here. Andy is calling in from Wyndham. Hi, Andy. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you doing, Jane? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment about talking about filling this middle ground and, you know, making sure that this food is able to be reached by all people. And I'm managing an organization right now called Wyndham Farm and Food, which delivers food from wholesale purchasers in the Wyndham County region. And takes it to institutions and schools, and also, and most importantly, possibly groups of consumers who are forming buying clubs and able to basically, you know, through the power of numbers, purchase from wholesale buyers and get that low cost. And we have like an 85% return of the farmers, so we're just doing it totally bare bones. We have no overhead and really just trying to provide a maximum return to farmers while also getting that food to those who might not be able to afford it otherwise.
Well, Andy, thanks for your call. Another innovative system there working in our region to try to make this local food movement work. We also got a note from Luke who says, don't forget the co-ops. The Upper Valley Co-op in White River Junction labels produce as local, and it goes out of its way to source a wide variety of produce from local farmers, which is awesome, Luke says. And Laura emails, I'm a new local food grower who has started to sell at farmers markets and just wanted to mention how great the farm-to-family coupons have been to get vegetables to low-income Vermonters. When they use their EBT cards, they can get coupons to double their dollars for local vegetables, another way to make sure that local food is accessible to more people. Just got a couple minutes left, and Martin and Philip, I'd love to hear from you where you see us going in the next couple of years. This Locavore Index that Vermont ranks at the top of is an annual thing, but give me your vision of the movement for the next decade, you know, in 10 words or less. Martin, you go first.
Well, I know Strolling of the Heifers is going to continue to advocate for local foods. We are looking at actually acquiring the River Garden in downtown Brattleboro and having that be kind of a food exhibit center and so forth, education center. So I think education and keep pushing the word out there.
Philip, what about for you?
Sure. I think we really need to continue the coordination that we're trying to do at the state level here. These conversations that are going on, I think, are some of the most complex in the country. And, you know, obviously, I don't want us to stop with the conversation. We really have to turn this into infrastructure and relationships and things that are really durable. And ultimately, you know, part of it is about being impatient, and ultimately part of it is also about being patient, because we've still got a long ways to go here.
That's Philip Ackerman Leist. He's the author of Rebuilding the Food Shed, How to Create Local, Sustainable, and Secure Food Systems. He's also a professor of sustainable agriculture at Green Mountain College and the owner of a small farm. Philip, thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you very much, Jane. It's been a pleasure. Pleasure as well, Martin.
And Martin is Martin Langeveld. He's the Strolling of the Heifers marketing director and coordinator of that locavore index that sparked this discussion. He joined us from VPR's brand new studio in Brattleboro. Martin, thank you for being on the program, and thanks for inaugurating the studio.
Yes, and thank you for having both of us, and thank you, Philip.
Coming up, how a couple of funny people are tweaking the world of fundraising. Instead of asking wealthy friends to donate to the worthy causes they support, they're putting on a show and filling up the seats at the Latches Theater. We'll explain in a minute on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This Saturday, patrons of the Latches Theater in Brattleboro will be treated to the tales of five veteran Stoller storytellers and humorists. The event is called Take a Seat, and the proceeds will help pay for replacing the seats in that theater. This is the first in what organizers hope will be a series of performances to benefit Southern Vermont cultural organizations. The group behind the effort is called The Hatch. One of the organizers is Tom Baudet, a regular panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Another is Rich Corson, a new Vermont resident who used to be the executive producer of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and The Colbert Report. I spoke with Tom and Rich this week and asked them to describe the lineup for this Saturday's show.
This is Tom. My friend P.J. O'Rourke from over in Jaffrey, New Hampshire is coming. Adam Wade. Rich, why don't you talk a little bit about Adam and how you know Adam?
Sure. This is Rich. Adam Wade, who is a Grand Slam storyteller from The Moth, worked for me for years and years at a comedy show that I produced, and he has become one of the best and brightest storytellers in the country. And he agreed to bring up some of his friends and other storytellers to Brattleboro to tell stories, humorous stories this weekend for us.
Yeah, in fact, Adam Wade has been a champion at The Moth, and there's another Moth storyteller coming.
Yes, we've got Peter Aguero and also
Jim O'Grady and Ed Gavigan.
Yeah, all of them have appeared on The Moth, and they've appeared on This American Life. What am I missing? Thank God we're taking.
Yes, going great.
You know who interests me is Jim O'Grady. I mean, he's also the transportation reporter with WNYC in New York, and you don't necessarily think of a transportation reporter as a fantastic storyteller.
Or being funny, necessarily.
Right.
And now,
I traditionally listen to him before I go to bed.
The lighter side of that bottleneck on the Roosevelt.
Right. I mean, how do you have that combination? That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, you know, this is what I personally love about this storytelling movement is that, you know, unlike comedy, which, you know, comedians are a rare and special breed, storytelling is always a part of comedy, but storytelling all by itself is this idea of someone telling you something true that happened to them. And in our world today, where we're so overconnected with our devices, but really underconnected in any real sense, this newly found appetite for storytelling comes from that. We really just crave someone telling us something true right to our faces. And that's where these guys come from. That's why Jim, who's a traffic reporter from New York, can do this as well as Jane Lindholm does.
You know, you both have mentioned that you know these storytellers personally. You've either worked with them or they've worked for you in some cases. So have you just called in a lot of favors to make friends come to this Brattleboro event and perform?
I'd say the short answer is yes.
Good. You've confirmed my suspicions.
Yes, you nailed it. There's no other way around it.
Yeah. Essentially, we were sitting around a table one morning, four of us, my wife, Rita, and I, and our friend Elizabeth Catlin, and Rich, myself. And we're all involved up to our necks in different things. Everything is fundraising all the time. And it's like, if I have one more pizza sale, I'm going to die from it. And I cannot do another raffle ticket. You know, I just can't. And we're sitting there, we're just basically complaining about this. There's got to be a way to do this better. There's got to be a way to do this and have fun, because these are our communities, and this is a necessary part of being involved in your community that we do. And that's when we start saying, well, what could we do? And Rich said, well, gosh, I've got a Rolodex filled with really funny people.
Tom's a little older, so he still uses a Rolodex.
Right, yeah. You said you have a Rolodex, Rich?
Right. I didn't use it. That's Tom's word, not mine.
All right. I didn't mean to insult Rich. He doesn't actually have a Rolodex.
Nobody does.
So what we realize is that between Rich and myself and our connections and the work that we do, that we knew a lot of really great people who are not only talented, but really, really good souls as well. And that we could ask them to come up and do these things for next to nothing, which they are, and to help us essentially raise money for good causes. Our first cause, as you said, is Take a Seat, which is to benefit this restoration of our historic Latches Theater downtown in Brattleboro. And we plan to do a couple of these events a year. That's what we're focused on now. We want to do another one in October. We want to find between now and then what the cause is going to be. That's kind of what our organization, The Hatch, is all about, is we're not raising money for ourselves. We don't do anything other than try to put the fund back into fundraising for other people. So, you know, we've talked to the hospital. You know, again, there's Girls on the Run. There's camps here and there. There is no end to the good causes that we could line up with and help out with their fundraising, because I'm sure they are as tired of raffles and pizza sales as everyone else.
Yeah.
Well, how are you going to figure out which causes? How do you make sure that it's not just the four of you picking your pet causes?
Well, that's what it's going to be, obviously. I mean, of course. I mean, if we can't lord over this, what is the point after all? Well, there may come a point when we've become, God help us, important enough where we're going to have to be careful about that,
mm-hmm.
and make sure we have a sort of a board that's advising us and all of that. At this point, we're just getting started. The Latches Arts Theater was a no-brainer because, number one, they have a theater.
Right.
And two, they really need seats.
Right.
We like going to the movies.
And we understand we're going to have to get a little more sophisticated about the way we go about things as we go forward. But in the meantime, the big and the broad point is to have fun raising money and to bring people into the donor program, if you will, who wouldn't normally contribute.
Well, and the tickets start at $25 and go up from there. You can pay as much as $1,000, and you're sort of a VIP, and obviously that's giving more than just buying a ticket. I'm curious, though, because, you know, part of the idea here is to raise money and then share the wealth among these organizations that are so valuable to you. But often our organizations, you say, that might be competing with one another for those donations. What do you think the fundraising potential of The Hatch actually is, at least in its first year? I mean, what are you actually imagining for the kind of money that you're going to be able to give to these kinds of organizations?
Well, we expect with this first event, we'll raise between $20,000 and $30,000 for Latches Arts. So it's significant for a small town fundraising effort. Going forward, as we get better at this, if you will, we hope that that number can only go up. A lot of these organizations, like I look at our local hockey organization, which I know about, and Girls on the Run Vermont, that if they can raise out of a community, you know, $20,000, $30,000 in a year, that is huge. That is a huge amount of money, and it takes a lot to do that. That's making a lot of phone calls, that's selling a lot of raffle tickets and auctions and all of the stuff that everyone who's listening to this knows so well. And we hope to be able to do that with a couple fun nights per year. And we just hope it's going to put a new spin on an old routine.
Rich, you're a fairly new Vermonter. I mean, you're certainly well-versed in showbiz. What is it about Vermont that's gotten you so invested in doing this kind of thing, sort of pro bono and for organizations in your community?
It's a good question. I think moving up here, my family and I moved up here a year and a half ago, and just getting to know folks in the area and people asking us to help out. And usually it's like, hey, would you mind helping us build something? Or can you help us in our garden? And I'm like, I don't have those skills. But I know how to put on funny shows. So Tom and I sat down and talked about it. And I was like, you know, that actually is something that maybe could be helpful. And I realized that being up here, if you don't get involved, you're sort of missing the point of living in a small community. It feels good to be able to impact a community. And I feel like this is just a different way of doing it and sort of lending what limited skills that I have to the area.
Yeah. And you know, we're starting here. If this thing continues to be received as it has been so far, we can imagine reaching out further into Vermont. Vermont is a small place. I mean, our communities don't really have boundaries when you think about it. One blends into the other pretty easily and quickly. You know, we have to focus on what we're doing right now, this weekend, but we're not putting any real boundaries on where we might be able to take this going forward.
Except New Hampshire. We are
not
New Hampshire. Helping New Hampshire. I just want to be clear about that.
You know we have a lot of listeners in New Hampshire. They're going to be very mad at you now.
What I meant was we're really happy to help New Hampshire as well.
That's what I thought you said.
Yeah, that's what I said. That's what I said.
Tom Baudet and Rich Corson are two of the organizers of The Hatch, a new effort in Brattleboro to raise money for arts and culture organizations. Their first event is called Take a Seat. It's this Saturday night at the Latches Theater. VPR is a media sponsor for Take a Seat, and you can learn more about the performance at vpr.net. One of the more intriguing trends in food over the last several years has been the transformation of food trucks from roach coaches to niche vendors that serve foodie customers. Vermont's food truck scene is tiny, and one notable fixture of it has left the street scene to open a restaurant in Winooski. Misery Loves Company is owned by three restaurant veterans who gained a ravenous and devoted following during the summer of 2012. VPR contributor Matt Bushlow tells their story.
Just after 9 o'clock on a gray winter morning, Chef Nate Wade slides chicken livers into a hot pan of olive oil.
These are the chicken livers for the mousse that we put down on the open-faced chicken salad sandwich we call the Second Avenue Deli.
Nate and his business partners, Laura Wade and Aaron Jasinski, never planned to launch their restaurant business by selling sandwiches out of a 40-year-old Winnebago. But that's just what they did last spring and summer. The motorhome they called Big Red became a fixture of the food scene around Burlington, and on the Facebook and Instagram feeds of local foodies.
It was important for us not to take jobs with other people so that we could stay focused on what we ultimately wanted to do, which was just open a restaurant. So we got really creative with what we could do and how we could make a little money.
The trio behind Misery Loves Company worked together at Burlington's Bluebird Tavern when that farm-to-table gastropub opened in 2009. Bluebird was nominated by the James Beard Foundation as the best new restaurant in the U.S. a year later. Only months after the nomination, all three moved on. Laura Wade says they had a single-minded desire to work for themselves.
We were doing anything from cooking barbecue in our backyard and delivering it to people's homes and to doing the pop-ups and also to selling food at the farmers market on Sundays. I mean, we were kind of just being as creative as possible and flexible as possible just to kind of keep focused and do what we love to do.
What they wanted to do was start their own restaurant. But with no money and an aversion to outside investors, they had to hustle to make ends meet. But then they happened upon an unexpected next step. A red and white 1972 Winnebago food truck was for sale in Montpelier. It was affordable, mobile, and had low overhead.
We always talked about food trucks and, you know, food carts, and it's an idea that, like, when it presented itself, we all knew that it was the right choice.
On an early afternoon, the restaurant's bright, simple dining room is full of people of all ages, their winter coats hanging off the backs of chairs. Aaron and Nate work the line in an open kitchen. Laura stands behind the counter taking lunch orders. Three chalkboards feature the day's menu. Sandwiches like the Korean Reuben, the Cuban American, and the porchetta have been standards since the Big Red days. Trays full of lemon curd donuts and other sweets are displayed next to a jar of house-made pickles. Jody Harrington of Winooski sits at a table nearby.
Today I had their smoked chicken wings. Totally delicious. A little decadent, but delicious.
Harrington is a regular who's followed the Misery crew since they first started Big Red. And even now that the restaurant is established, Harrington and other fans will have a chance to grab a sandwich on the street again this summer. Nate, Aaron, and Laura say the food truck is close to their hearts, and they will staff it with cooks and get it back out on the road soon. For VPR, I'm Matt Bushler.
And that'll do it for today's show. Tomorrow, Bob Kinzel will be hosting, and he'll be joined by former Governor Jim Douglas. Bob, what are you planning to discuss?
Jane, Douglas has some ideas about how to rebuild the Republican Party. He thinks the GOP needs to broaden its base by allowing different points of view on some key issues and by making the party less ideologically pure.
All right, and if you have questions for Jim Douglas or want to weigh in on where you think the Vermont GOP should go, send them to vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson and Jennifer Brandt. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.